It's the money.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Thomas Ferguson, who's a professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. He's a member of the advisory board of George Soros' Institute for New Economic Thinking and a contributing editor to The Nation. And he's also the author of Golden Rule, The Investment Theory of Part Competition and the Logic of Money-Driven Political Systems. He also has an article at Alternate revealed why the pundits are wrong about big money and the 2012 elections. Welcome to Background Briefing, Thomas Ferguson.
Hi there.
And why are the pundits wrong about big money?
Well, okay. First, let me just say it's not just my article, but my two co-authors, Paul Jorgensen and Ji Chen. But the pundits are wrong because, you know, it was pretty weird. If you all through the main event, that is to say the real election campaign, you could see plenty of coverage about super PACs, money flowing everywhere, and yet even very stupid people could see that when, say, somebody like Sheldon Adelson just gets up and talks about how he'll keep Newt Gingrich in the race or not, I mean, sort of like one of the Olympian gods in the Iliad sort of deciding whether he's going to Zeus letting the Trojans or the Greeks win, you could get the impression that, you know, big money is really important in these elections. The day the election happened, the day afterward, actually, the line started, well, you know, all this stuff didn't really matter. After all, Obama won. And then amazingly, we had claims that the House of Representatives elections were not seriously affected by money. Even the Sunlight Foundation put out a study. Sunlight has, you know, done a lot of good work on money and politics. They claimed, their study, though, claimed they couldn't find any influence. My colleagues and I looked at each other and said, we know this can't be right. And so we started working through the data. And it was easy to see that, in fact, what we saw was so amazing, a virtual straight-line relationship between the percentage of cash compared to the Republicans in the race that the Democrat had and his or her final vote totals. I mean, you know, the graph's right up there. And I don't, even I don't think that reflects the true state of the situation completely. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that is more complicated than that, but it's still an amazing graph no matter how many qualifications you make. Then if you look, I mean, in particular, a lot of folks might sort of reasonably ask, isn't it the case that if there's a small chance that you'll win, you wouldn't give, say, that Democrat running much money? I entirely agree with that criticism. On the other hand, our next move to try to check for that type of stuff was to look at races where, you know, your best take is they ought to have a better-than-average chance of being won by either side. Now, these are not the so-called formal list of toss-up races, because I think those are influenced by people's views of how much money is in there. But we took all of the races that had been won by Republicans for the first time in 2010, and then we looked at a subset of those which had been won in Democratic districts. And in both those cases, you'd figure a one-term Republican couldn't probably entrench themselves as well as an incumbent in there for, you know, 6, 8, 10 terms. What we found was in those races, on average, was an enormous Republican advantage in money. And I think the only reasonable thing you can conclude in the House race is that, you know, claims that money didn't matter are ridiculous. It obviously did. In fact, on the face of it, it looks so much that it mattered, it's almost beyond belief. Now, that brings us to the question of the presidential race. Now, we had been working on presidential finances, but your problem with presidential finances is there's a large lag in reporting and what you can see at the time the race is going on in real terms, in real time. So what we did in the mid-October, late October, was to look at the cash trends up to that point. It looked like Romney might blow past Obama in the final weeks of the campaign. After the campaign, the campaign reports came in. And, in fact, that didn't happen. what happened was that, in fact, the Obama campaign saw a big influx of cash, and they spent a lot of it. Depending on how you count, because there's a lot of committees that parties use to help presidential candidacies. It is a somewhat murky business on the edges. By one estimate, which is not unreasonable, although it's probably not the way I do it, the gap between the total spending of the Romney and the Obama campaigns in the end came to about $6 million out of a total of $3 billion. In other words, they ran almost dead even. And what I conclude from that is basically that this was basically a kind of battle between King Kong and Godzilla. Think of it as two factions of the 1%. I think that's basically what you had just happen. I mean, it's not at all paradoxical that the Obama campaign won.
Now, there was some reporting of the gerrymandering and the fact that the Democrats in the House actually got more votes than the Republicans, but the Republicans ended up with a majority. So what do you make of that?
Well, first thing to say is that gerrymandering happens, absolutely for sure. I don't know of anybody who's actually looked at all 50 states. There are studies with less than those, including a lot of what appear to be the worst cases. When you look at the states that look like worst cases, what you'll find is there's a Republican advantage, but it's not enormous. The Democrats did gerrymandering, too. They did it in California, and they did it in Illinois, for example, where they appear to have helped themselves with some extra seats. So in that sense, it doesn't work just one way. But I'd agree that the Republicans got a net advantage. The other problem with that, particularly the sort of the vote seats calculations that you're talking about, though, is that there's a substantial amount of evidence about what you might call the geographic centralization of the Democratic vote. I mean, put simply and somewhat hyperbolically, if you're all in big city areas and metro centers, you'll cast a lot of votes for the same candidate. And that'll produce those sort of top-heavy percentage totaling that you just mentioned yourself. And in that sense, there's too much emphasis on redistricting as opposed to this other possible influence. That's not to say that redistricting doesn't happen, but the geographic centralization is pretty well documented in the political science literature, and I think it's right. So I wouldn't, in other words, go overboard on gerrymandering, but for heaven's sake, it really happens.
Sure. But when you mentioned, Tom Ferguson, that gerrymandering had taken place here in the state of California by Democrats, the new law has gone into effect. That was pushed through by Schwarzenegger, which gets rid of gerrymandering, and the redistricting is done by an independent panel of retired judges. So.
I misspoke. You're exactly right on that. And what I should have said was getting rid of the gerrymandering there helped the Democrats.
Right, right. Yep. So the irony is, and we see the antics of the House, and we've seen what's been happening over this so-called fiscal cliff phony theater that's got everybody all worked up. And you've seen how Boehner was humiliated by his own Tea Party caucus, who he clearly can't control. And it's pretty hard to believe these Tea Party people who objected to the vote. They refused to allow billionaires and millionaires to be taxed. They really went to the mat for the millionaires, and yet these are supposed to be these right-wing populists who formed the Tea Party as a result of what happened on Wall Street with the 2008 collapse. I don't understand it. Are they driven by ideology?
Why isn't the simple explanation the right one, Ian? That is to say that there's a lot of millionaires who gave a lot of money who don't want to be taxed.
Exactly.
The point is exactly right. This discussion that's going on today, if you look in Thomas Friedman's column in the New York Times, he says the Republican Party has an inmate problem. He's referring to an old quote of Lester Maddox about Georgia prisons, that it wasn't the prisons but the inmates that were the problem. In fact, and the comparison is to Republican voters. I mean, yes, there is a large number of, well, close to nut cases there, but you're also looking at a lot of money, massive amounts of it. And I understand that the Business Roundtable has now formally decided that they'd accept some kind of package that raised taxes on the super rich. But, you know, look, the history on those deals suggests that often a lot of folks give verbal agreement, then they don't really mean it. They don't push very hard. And everybody sort of knows that, while the intense folks stay right in cement. And, I mean, as you called, I was just sort of looking through the roster of Republican groups, like the Club for Growth, for example, Jim DeMint's PAC, Political Action Committee. You know, he left the Senate. But he had a political action committee. These folks were very well funded, and they give to the hard right in the Republican Party. And I suspect I'm going to return to that theme with my colleagues very soon. I mean, I think basically what's going on with the fiscal cliff is a battle inside big money inside the Republican Party. Remember, this is a party who was widely considered within it that Mitt Romney was too far to the left. Now, Romney, in the end, collected an enormous amount of money, but there was a substantial amount, even of billionaires, pushing, you know, Rick Santorum and Newt Gingrich. And there's a lot of lesser money there. And frankly, that's, I think, the war going on inside the Republican Party right now. That's the thing that's sort of stalling the fiscal cliff. If you look at congressional behavior over time, you'll notice if the guys get pushed into a position they really find difficult, they'll give some excuse to the electorate, they'll explain themselves, and they'll confect some way to do it. You don't get that kind of iron discipline out of electoral politics. The mechanisms in the United States are just not that tight. Particularly when you know, like the stuff that's been in the Wall Street Journal or even the New York Times the last couple of weeks about, well, these people got safe seats and they're elected by Republicans. You know, that can't be true in general that could affect this issue. I mean, we know that majority opinion in the United States on most national polls has a something like a 2-to-1 or even 3-to-1 majorities for raising taxes on the rich. It is not possible that district opinion in a majority of the congressional districts of the United States, which are Republican, is going to be that far from that opinion. These guys are not heeding public opinion in their district. They're heeding money, and that's what gives them the sort of scary iron discipline here. You can't get that kind of steadfast politics out of American election popular influences. You just can't. It's money that's talking here.
Well, Tom Ferguson, it used to be, though, the Senate was referred to as the money house. It's where the plutocrats were taken care of and had undue influence, and that the Congress was always called the people's house. It seems that it's reversed now, and that the Congress has become the money house, at least on the Republican side. If you consider, for example, John Boehner, who just got humiliated by the Tea Party, he nevertheless ran unopposed for re-election, and he raked in almost $21 million in contributions. And then you've got Eric Cantor, who's trying to get his job and breathing over his shoulder. And he took in $7.6 million and another $5.4 million for his leadership PAC. And if you contrast that with Nancy Pelosi, the Democratic minority leader, she raised only $2.3 million, which is less than what Chevron alone donated to Boehner's super PAC. And then, of course, she brought in a slightly over $1 million for her leadership PAC. So money talks.
Yes, it does. I would observe, though, that in the Senate it's still talking plenty. When Mitch McConnell and Harry Reid sit down, I mean, you're really talking, in both cases, significant influence out of New York on both of them. It's one reason I think that in the end they'll probably do some kind of a deal, because on January 1st the position of the millionaires deteriorates. That is to say, they actually all get their taxes raised, and probably by more than they would if they don't do a deal. But, you know, I I may be wrong. I do think that Boehner made a tactical error in bringing up his plan B so early, because it put, I mean, there's just no way, if these folks finally do a fiscal cliff deal, that they can vote this except at the last second. You just have, if you're going to disappoint your backers, you're going to have to look like you really made an effort. And, you know, doing it before Christmas was not in the cards. I thought even at the time that this was a crazy idea of Boehner's. But, you know, let's just see what happened. But let's understand what the problem is. The Republican Party, you have a very serious block of money that is effectively so far out of the mainstream in popular thinking that it's scary.
Well, the Republicans certainly have caused a lot of damage. The whole reason they have this phony fiscal cliff is because of the tantrum that the Tea Party had over the last raising of the debt ceiling, and now they brought about this sequester mechanism, which actually may be the only way that we'll ever get any cuts. One of the things that I find extraordinary about what's happening, and it hasn't gotten much attention, is that either Obama's plan or Boehner's plan will end up with the least amount of discretional spending in a budget since Eisenhower. So either way, they're shrinking the government radically, and the government is rapidly becoming a war machine and a pension plan, and nothing else.
This is a problem. I would add it will be very similar under any deal that's likely between Obama and the Republicans. Not going to be that far from that. The one thing you get if you do the fiscal cliff deal is you don't get the immediate deflationary impact of big cuts in federal spending, which, you know, if you were to persist for some months, would be a problem. I mean, the fiscal cliff is not a cliff. It's a slope. Goes just down. It's a gentle slope, but really does go way down. I mean, you would certainly have a recession if you did not do something about the fiscal cliff after, say, 3, 4, or 5 months.
Well, but the problem is that the trajectory that we're on, whether it's Obama or Boehner's plan or a combination of both, plays right into Grover Norquist's idea that we're going to shrink government down to a size where we can drown it in a bathtub.
I agree. I do not disagree with this. I hope nothing I've said makes you think I do.
No, but I'm leaving our audience with a recognition, Tom, that this is the real challenge. We have to ask ourselves, do we live in the civilized world, and do we want a government commensurate with our needs, or are we prepared to live in a third world America?
I would simply add to that if you, in effect, defeat one person financed by about $1.5 billion by another financed at just about the same rate, it's not very surprising if a good deal of their package on budget spending and even income taxes, waiving, you know, the question of a 2 or 3% rise on the very richest Americans, look a lot alike. Your problem in American politics is money. It's nothing else is nearly as important as that. Everything else is secondary or even tertiary.
Well, Tom Ferguson, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks very much, Ian. Bye. It's always a pleasure. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Again, I've been speaking with Tom Ferguson, who is a professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. He's a member of the advisory board for George Soros' Institute for New Economic Thinking and a contributing editor to The Nation magazine. He's also the author of Golden Rule, The Investment Theory of Part Competition and the Logic of Money-Driven Political Systems. And he has an article at Alternet revealed why the pundits are wrong about big money and the 2012 elections. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with the anti-consumer activist, the Reverend Billy.
People don't.